Off the Ball, GAA.
This year I just had a lot of motivation to right the wrongs of last year, because I didn't have a good year last year personally, so that was a big thing for me.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Settle in on Off the Ball, brought to you by Guinness 0.0.
So much happening.
You were welcome along to Settle In. Delighted to say the next guest in our series in partnership with Guinness 0.0 is Mayo and Ballyhadrine footballer Shiroz Akram. Shiroz, welcome to the studio. How are you keeping?
I'm good, Owen. Thanks a million for having me now.
This has been a busy old year for you. Your life has been a brilliant story, which has been told plenty of times before. And then in 2025, Senior Championship comes along. So this must sit there as a fairly special year in what has been an incredible life.
Absolutely, yeah. I think when you're growing up as a young fella, you always want to kind of push on and make your county debut. So I was fortunate enough to do that, even though I was at a young age of 28 years old.
Yeah, I was going to ask what age you are at this point, because it's not too off the mark to describe you as a bit of a wunderkind of Mayo GAA when you burst onto the scene. First year out of minor, you're straight into the under-21s and you arrive on the scene, I guess, better late than never to finally make your mark in senior football.
Yeah, so I suppose I was fortunate enough to represent Mayo at minor and under-21 levels, and then a little bit unfortunate, I suppose, when GAA cut the under-21 campaign to under-20, so I actually missed out on my good year at under-21s, and I was involved then with the senior panel for a year and a bit. It just didn't work out at the time, with family reasons, personal stuff happening, travel, all the other bits and pieces that are involved. I was setting up a business too, so I've been away from the scene for maybe 5 or 6 years, and then I'd say my club performances probably didn't justify getting called back in or being involved back in the panel. But thankfully now last year with the club, we got to a county semi-final, and I was going well, the body was holding up, so the management gave me an opportunity to get involved with the panel again, and I was just delighted to be involved and then go on to make my debut against Leitrim.
Brilliant. We'll come back to that in a while. I am keen to tell the story of Shiroz Akram today, because not everybody's going to be familiar. You come to Ireland at the age of 4 from Pakistan. What do you remember of that time in your life?
I suppose of Pakistan, it was a completely different environment, completely different setup. As a 4-year-old, you don't know a lot, you don't remember a lot. So I was just going into preschool at the time, starting to pick up the language, starting to learn to read and write, which I still can't do. So I can't read or write my own language. I can speak it. And then fast forward to 2 or 3 weeks later, suddenly you arrive in Ballyhadrine in the west of Ireland. And we landed in, I think, in December. So it was a winter period. It was cold. There was snow. So I was experiencing certain parts of the elements and the weather for the first time. And then I think within a couple of weeks, I think it was mid to late January, I was in primary school. So I turned 5 within a couple of weeks of arriving. And I was in primary school. And then you're going into school. Obviously, my parents don't have the language. I don't have the language. And you're going into a place where you don't have too many people from Pakistan in the class that you can communicate with that can help you. So the first couple of weeks now were daunting. Couple of months were daunting.
Yeah.
Going into school and just trying to communicate with the teachers and with my peers and with my friends in school was difficult.
As a 3-4-year-old, you're essentially learning two languages at once then. You're learning your language from Pakistan at home while also trying to develop English in school and with your friends. It's amazing how young people can actually do that. And I'm sure it was second nature to you at that time. For an adult to try and do that would have been impossible.
Yeah, I think because I was at such a young age, it nearly helped me in the sense that I was able to pick up things from the very get-go. Like even with Irish, not just English, I would have done
true,
Irish.
True languages.
Yeah, so I would have done Irish from the start as well. Whereas if I'd come a couple of years later, I don't think I would have been exposed to the Irish language. I don't think I would have picked it up either. It's just a little bit more difficult. But especially with the English, I would say now I'm pretty good at speaking it and reading it and writing it, whereas let's say my parents would have struggled with the language, and then my brother in primary school wouldn't have done Irish either, so it was a little bit harder for him because he was a little bit older than me.
When your family leave Pakistan to come to Europe, what was the reasoning behind it?
So it was work. It was a better prospect at life. So my uncle, my mum's side, her older brother, was based in Ireland, in Balhadrin, actually. So he kind of helped get the family moved across just to give us a better chance at life. In Pakistan, the opportunities for education, for work, aren't the same. And to be able to have that, to get over here, has been huge for me, I suppose, and my brother and my family.
So obviously the uncle had settled in well. He was like, Ireland's a great place, come on over, everyone.
Yeah, he was here maybe a couple of years, and he'd set up a business, and then he was well linked in with the community. So he helped my dad get a job at the time. Don Meat's factory was in Balhadrin at the time, that employed a lot of kind of people from the Pakistani community at the get-go. So he helped Dad get over and get a job there, and then settle into the area, help with housing and stuff, and get us kind of set up in the school system.
It's brilliant, and like, it's still obviously such a strong community in Balhadrin as well at the moment. The Donnelly's factory is closed at this stage, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been gone maybe a good 15-16 years. But it was a lot of the reasons why a lot of Pakistanis originally moved to Balhadrin, because they were one of the major employers for people from, I suppose, foreign backgrounds.
How easy was it for your family to embed itself into Irish culture, either through friendships, through sport, whatever the case may be? I'm sure for a four-year-old child, it's very easy. You're in school and you're mixing with people. But for your parents, for your uncle even, do you know how easy it was for them to actually settle in here?
For my uncle, I suppose I can't speak on his behalf, but he had a business in town. He used to run a store, a clothes shop, so he would have kind of had a lot of people coming in and out to him, and then his wife was Irish as well, so that kind of helped. Then I suppose in my parents' perspective, it helped having kids in school, so when they were doing school runs, you'd meet other parents, and then as we picked up sports ourselves, got to meet other friends and other parents, they got to integrate into the community through that. And I suppose a lot of my dad's friends that are Irish are through me picking up sports at a young age, that are involved with the local GAA club or the soccer club. So that really helped him.
Were you better at GAA or soccer at that stage?
I was soccer.
Yeah.
Yeah. As you can imagine, a Pakistani household doesn't have a lot of Gaelic football on, or RTE or TG Cahir. There was none of that in our household. It was all Asian channels. But you would watch the soccer World Cups, the championship, European championships, and then the Premier League. So I was always a soccer head. I'd say up until about 15, 16, that's all I wanted to do, and that's what my dad was trying to push me to be good at, but it didn't go that way.
What was on the TV at home?
So we would have watched matches a day.
Okay.
I suppose at the weekends, myself and my brother religiously watched it for a couple of years there. Saturday, Sunday, we used to be on, staying up late watching that. And then whenever the World Cup or something was on, that would be on at home as well. But outside of that, it was kind of Pakistani channels that were similar to Ireland here, the reality shows or their kind of series or whatever. That's what's generally on in our household.
Brilliant. Do you remember like storylines and characters from those TV shows? Because I'd imagine it's your best way of actually keeping in touch with Pakistan at that point.
Not a whole pile, no. So as a young fella now, what I tried to do was, you'd get home from school, you'd get your work done. Or in some cases, I didn't get it done, and I was outside just kicking ball in the garden, playing with my brother. I had a couple of friends in the estate, so we'd be playing football or cricket. And then you come in the evening, and then you have to worry about getting your homework done and then getting to school. So that's how most of my evenings were spent.
Was cricket a big thing in Balhadrin?
Cricket started up a couple of years after we moved in. Again, having the community there from Pakistan helped to develop that. And it's still going. The cricket club's going pretty strong. The first couple of years, they won the Connacht League and championships. My brother played it quite a bit. I was very young. They didn't have underage teams. It was just a senior team. So I used to just go train with the guys or help out wherever I could. But I never actually played a whole pile of cricket myself.
The soccer was a real success story for you. Anybody who knows what it takes to make a Kennedy Cup team will realise that the level that you got to, because you were captain of the Roscommon Kennedy Cup team, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, yeah. So I would have played with Roscommon, so it's funny. We play our Gaelic football in Mayo, and then we play our soccer in Roscommon. So we get a bit of abuse from both sides when we were playing. When we were younger, we were playing soccer on the Roscommon side, they'd be sledging you about the Mayo side. And now that we're playing football in Mayo and representing Mayo, you have them representing you that you're a Rossi and whatever else. So it's a good bit of banter. But no, it was good to get exposed to the Kennedy Cup. And then after that, I was involved in like the regional centres. At the time, it was like a combination of Sligo, Leitrim, Mayo and Roscommon combined. So I was involved with those panels for 2 years. I was up and down to Dublin for Irish trials and stuff as well. And then I made like an under 16 Connacht team, and we won an All Ireland with that as well. So soccer, I suppose, was my go-to. And then I was kind of over back to a couple of League of Ireland clubs at under 19 level. So Galway, Sligo, Athlone. But at the end, it's just travel. My dad was a sole earner. We only had one car, and getting to these places quite frequently and quite regularly just wasn't going to be possible. So that had to be put on the back burner, and that was kind of it.
And I presume you were the only one from Ballyhadrin trying out for these clubs as well, so it's not like you could carpool or you had a friend who you could cut the cost with in terms of travel expenses even.
For Kennedy Cup, we had a couple from Ballyhadrin that were going, and to be fair to the parents, they were really, really good with me. Like John Kelly now, he used to be the senator from town. He'd done a lot of taxiing. My business partner Keane, his parents, Andy Hanley, there was a number of parents that done a lot of taxiing for me, so I'm really thankful for that. If it wasn't for them, I don't think the opportunities would have opened up. But then come to the regional centres and the League of Ireland clubs, I was the only one, and it just wasn't going to work out. And with one of the clubs, I had a negative experience too. Okay. So that kind of put me off the soccer side of things, and I was like, okay, that's that for me.
You're far from the only person who would have had a negative experience in this sort of world where professionalism is the end goal. What was it about that experience for you that pushed you away from soccer?
So at the time I was 16, and I was involved with the Mayo under 16 panel as well, and we'd got to the Ted Webb final. I was one of the joint captains of the team, and we were through to the Connacht final as such, and I was trialling out with Sligo at the time, and I was basically given the ultimatum, it's one or the other, that I have to sign and that's it, and that I can't play the final. And I just asked for a week or 2 weeks just to see out the final, and then I said I was happy to give it up. But I wasn't given that opportunity, and that just left a sour taste in my mouth. So I said, maybe it's not for me, especially if at a young age, if we're going to be pressurising kids to make such big decisions. That wasn't something I was prepared to do at the time.
It's such a common story around Ireland of people having clashes between Gaelic games and with soccer in particular, and kids being forced to choose between one or the two. It really is hard to see a benefit from it or an outcome where everybody is satisfied. And it does seem to hold kids back quite a lot. It doesn't seem the way forward at all.
I don't think it should be the way that we should be perceiving things. I feel kids at a young age, they're developing. They should be given, I suppose, exposure to everything. Because you might develop skills in one sport that might go on to help you in another sport. The sport that you originally pick up mightn't be the sport that you end up playing. So I think it's important to let kids make that decision themselves when the time is right for themselves. And people will realise, as you get older, you realise you can't be doing something every day of the week. So you will cut down yourself. But I think it should be left up to the child where possible, rather than forcing them in a corner where they have to make that decision.
Can I ask you, Shiroz, when it comes to your own identity during your childhood, did you feel different at all, given your background, or did the fact that you were embedded in a community that was full of people from parts of the world that were similar to yours, did that make it easier? Did it make you settle in a little bit more, or was there always an element of trying to fit in, or realising that you were in the minority to an extent?
Yeah, so I suppose when we first moved over, there wasn't that many Pakistani people. The community wasn't as large, so there wouldn't have been as many interactions with Pakistani people. It would have been a handful of people. As time has progressed, that's increased. But at the very get-go, you know, as a child, you are a little bit different. You look different. Your culture is different. Your food is different. The way you dress is different. Everything is different. So you do pick up those things. And I suppose there is that peer pressure to try and fit in. Like anyone else, when you're exposed to a specific environment, you want to be a part of that and feel like you're not different to that. So I would have tried my best to kind of fit in primary school conversations. So that's, I suppose, when Gaelic football came into my life. Everyone was talking about it. People were playing it. They were going to county games or club games, whereas I was completely alien to it. I didn't know anything about it. So that was me trying to fit into the culture and the community by picking up Gaelic football and being involved in the community.
So I did wonder if the Kennedy Cup thing is actually a big moment for you in that regard. Like, even when I think about this, like, fitting in isn't necessarily something that anybody has to do. Being perceived to be different, it can sometimes be something that people love, and maybe for you, your experience is an entirely positive one. But I did wonder if, like, captaining the Kennedy Cup team, it was that like a moment of status or achievement where you're like, Jesus, look at what I've done, and this is a big moment for me.
Absolutely. I think if you go on to captain any team, whether that's your local club team or whatever team, to any level, I think is a huge honour. So it was an honour for me. But at a young age, when I talk about fitting in, your mindset is completely different. Whereas when you grow older, you realise actually being different is a part of human nature. Anyone that's different, there's nothing wrong with them. You know, they're their own individual and their own person. And I think mentioning the captain in the Kennedy Cup team, that helped in the fact that people, I suppose, seen me as a sports person, that I was good at a specific sport. So that helped on the sports pitch, or helped when we were training or playing with the local club. But outside of that, you're still then a normal person. You're a 13-year-old kid that is trying to fit into their community, that's trying to make friends with kids in primary school, and then you're progressing on into secondary school, where that pool of friends and colleagues is getting bigger. And again, you're trying to find your place in that environment.
I know we're jumping around here, but when did you realise that individuality was a good thing? Because a 13-year-old boy doesn't necessarily realise that at all. It's much the opposite.
I'd say probably 17, 18.
Right.
As a child growing up, I would have been actually really, really shy as well.
Yeah.
Like, I know I've done a couple of interviews since and gone on to do a bit of media work, but growing up, I remember I'd be sitting in primary school or secondary school. And do you know the way in primary school, you know you're going to be reading a paragraph or a passage in a book or whatever you're reading at the time, and I was nearly counting to see where I was coming, because I knew I'd be coming up for a specific paragraph, and you nearly be practicing it, that you don't misread something or you don't mess up, and your eyes are nearly watering looking at the page because you're so nervous. And well, I was anyways, at least, because I didn't want to, I suppose, mess up or make a fool of myself. Whereas when you get 17, 18 years old, you've developed and you've had those life experiences where you're like, if I do, so what? Do you know, everyone is human. People make errors or people make mistakes. And if I don't fit in, I'm absolutely fine with that.
Talk to us about the role of Gaelic Games then. At which stage of your life do you start to realise that this is something that you're going to become good at? Because it does feel that maybe you start a little bit later than some other people your own age in Mayo, or what's the timeline for Gaelic football?
Yeah, so I was in fifth class at the time, and I think I've mentioned this a couple of times. So Andy and his now wife, Jenny, used to come in and take PE classes with us. And he kind of nudged me and pushed me. Again, I mentioned his energy is so infectious. It nearly kind of wanted me to take over. He's making you seem as if you're going to be really good at this. And this is a sport I don't know the rules of. I don't know anything about. And he's telling, oh yeah, you should definitely play with the school. You should go join up with the school team and then the club team. So he kind of gave me the push. And then Paul McHugh, he's actually managed our senior team now on two different occasions. Him and Desi were the school coaches at the time. They kind of took me under their wing, helped me progress, and then brought me into the local club. And from there, all the coaches have just been, excuse me, really, really helpful. At the very start, my skill set was really, really poor. I wouldn't say, I probably still is poor. But it was more, I suppose, my athleticism that they kind of seen, and that I was a little bit quicker or faster or a little bit fitter, that they kind of seen, and there might be potential here. So they were happy to work on that. I remember talking out for my under-12s team, and we'd maybe 17 players, like Balhadrin, at underage level. At times we don't have a lot of numbers at underage, and there was 17 players, and I'm not sure if it was 15 aside or 13 aside, but I remember looking at one stage, I was one of two subs, and I kind of going, right, okay, this is what I'm kind of up against. But from there, I had to work hard, but I also had to be given the time to learn the rules and be shown the skills. I think for my very first game, I went out, and you're nearly put in corner forward or corner back, or just somewhere you're not really going to impact the game as much, but you're still getting a run out. And I remember the ball came up to me, and I didn't know what to do, so I just picked it straight up off the ground. Again, not understanding the rules, but thankfully the coaches kind of gave me the time of day to explain the rules and develop my skills, and I've progressed on from there.
That's a great kind of moment to illustrate just how important patient coaching is, and teaching children how to play the game, as opposed to pushing kids into a situation where they have to win every single game, especially at that level.
Yeah, I suppose for me, again, the coaches might have been trying to win a game or whatever, but I didn't know about it. They went about it the right way for me, to help me develop my skills. And thankfully, then come under 16s, I went from not being starting on my club team to then come under 16 level. I was on the county team and I was one of the captains of the team. So it shows that in a short time frame, if you're given the right environment to kind of progress in, that people can push on.
The Andy Moran factor here is fascinating. Like for people who are from Ballyhadrian, I'm sure they're very well familiar with Andy coming into the schools. I didn't realise his other half was actually coming in with him as well. The two of them were doing this. Was this kind of like in a games development officer capacity, where I think everybody around Ireland would have had the coach come in on a Thursday morning or whatever the case may be, go out for an hour whatever the situation would have been? Was he that person basically for Ballyhadrian in the surrounding areas?
Sure, if he was the games development officer, he used to come in and take pee, as far as I can remember.
Okay.
He might correct me on this now.
Yeah.
So between both of them, they used to come in and take PE with the different classes throughout the school. And then I suppose I can't thank him enough, not just for pushing me into the sport, but what he's done for me since. There's a couple of other stories. I remember at minor, I was struggling with an injury, and I remember chatting to him. And again, I couldn't get over to the physio. He came, collected me, drove me to the physio, made sure I was seen to, and then drove me and dropped me back home. Just things like that, where he goes above and beyond, not just for me. I'm sure he's done for many other people that just haven't had the chance to share that kind of story about him.
Yeah, it's amazing.
The John Giles era with Off the Ball has come to an emotional end.
Off the Ball wouldn't exist the way it does without the existence of John Giles.
Helped by a plethora of John's friends and family within and without football, we pay tribute to the great man in front of a selected audience.
So we are here tonight to celebrate not just the impact John has had on Off the Ball over the last 20 years or so, but really the unrivaled impact that he's had on Irish football going back 70 years.
This week in the OTB football feed, look out for the full John Giles tribute night.
If we didn't say John was the best player I've ever played with, he would tell you why he was.
Eddie, I might come to that in a minute.
Yeah.
We speak to John himself about his 7 decades in football, former Leeds teammates Eddie Gray and Joe Jordan, plus tributes from Liam Brady, Brian Kerr and many more.
As you say, it's what, 20 odd?
23 years.
20 years. Well, they did well to put up with me for 20.
Released in 3 parts, we'll drop the first part of the John Giles tribute night on Tuesday morning. And to mark the occasion, it will be available for free for a limited time only. The John Giles tribute, only available in your OTB football feed.
To go from under 12s to be thrown in as one of the two subs into a corner forward, picking the ball straight off the ground, to being on the Mayo under 16 team, that's quite the progress in a short enough space of time, isn't it?
At the time, I suppose I wouldn't have paid heed to it, but now looking back at it, generally you wouldn't have that level of progress. But I was thankful, like I mentioned, the coaches helped me out. Again, not having a lot of numbers at underage helps as well. So when you're playing a year or two above you, that kind of pushes you to develop your skills a little bit more and get better at specific aspects of the game that you mightn't necessarily have done at your own age level. But then having good club guys like Andy, I've mentioned, Mike Solon, who went on to manage under 20s and under 21s, John Ginty, these sort of guys that were really, really good fellas, really, really good coaches, giving young kids the time of day to develop, and that's kind of shown in the club team where guys have progressed on and gone on to represent Mayo. Like if you look at my business partner Keane, he would have represented Mayo. Seamus Kniff, again, he would have been in around my age. There's a good group of them. Ryan Lynch would have been on our under 21 team. And since that, you've David McBrien obviously playing a huge role on the senior team at the moment. And then Kuba's kind of thereabouts as well. So it's down to these sort of guys that have given the underage that time to develop them.
Does Andy Moran become a bit of a mentor to you individually over those few years as you're developing from the person who's learning the sport to the person who would eventually go on and star for Mayo at underage level?
Yeah, actually I would have linked in with them quite a lot, not just on the football side of things. So anything outside of football, if I was having trouble with specific things, I would have always reached out to him and picked his brain and got his advice on certain things. And then coming near the end of my college years, I had a placement to do as well, and he took me on in his gym as well.
Oh,
so
no
I
way.
Worked for him for a couple of months as well, so he's helped me out on all fronts, to be fair to him.
What's he like to work for?
I'd rather not say.
Yeah.
I know. Between him and Jenny now, they were really, really good. Again, they were only starting out in the gym in Loughlanna. They'd just taken over that facility, so it was all new to them. The gym had just recently opened up. I really enjoyed my couple of months there, but my own business was progressing, so I stepped away from that and went into my own business then.
So I was sitting beside him at one of the league games in Castlebar this year, and he pointed out the gym. You can actually see it from the stand in Castlebar. Massive facility there. He's obviously massively successful. I'm not sure, was it always there? Did he move from Balladrian into Castlebar, or what the situation has been?
No, I think he always set up in Castlebar. Yeah. So the movement gyms, I suppose, that was the original site that he's in now. And then the leisure centre I worked in was the council-run facility that he took over, the Lochlannan Leisure Centre with the swimming pool. So that's where I was mainly.
Yeah. You'd struggle to find anybody who has a bad word to say about Andy Moore, and like, he's obviously done a bit of work with us on the punditry side of things. Glowing reviews, obviously brilliant to anybody who listened to him. Monaghan, I'd say, would have brilliant things to say about him, as you touched on at the start. Leitrim would have very, very good things to say about him as well. But that's only one aspect of him. On the other aspect, you have Footballer of the Year. You have somebody who's got a great deal of success about him. The old cliche about nice guys not finishing first and all that doesn't seem to wash through with Andy Moore. He seems to be an absolute gent of a fella, whilst also somebody you'd kind of trust to maybe be the guy who'd get Mayo to the promised land one day in the coaching world.
Yeah, I think people say nice guys don't always finish in a good place or whatever, but he's a prime example of the complete opposite. He's so good with people. Like, he was coaching Leitrim, he was managing Leitrim, but at the same time he was taking, I think, the under-6s or under-8s in the club to training sessions as well. So it's not a case where he's moved on and just forgot about his club or forgot about his roots. We'd done a fundraiser in COVID where we were trying to raise funds for a new AstroTurf, and he was one of the driving forces behind that. So if somebody's saying a bad word about him, it might be because they're from Roscommon and he wasn't playing for Roscommon. So outside of that, I can't see people having too much bad things to say about him.
I am fascinated, Charles, in the trajectory of your intercounty career, and we kind of touched on it at the top of this interview. Not every intercounty career is straightforward or follows a straight line. Can you tell us why it's taken until the age of 28 to make your senior championship debut, and what's happened in the intervening years? I'm sure COVID's played a big part that disrupted the lives of many people. You've had plenty of stuff going on in your own life in terms of professional stuff, in terms of college and living above in Dublin, so it's not always been straightforward for you. But what are the other factors that have been at play over the last few years?
I suppose when you're coming out of minor under 21s and you've represented Mayo, you think you're just going to progress and make that step and it's just going to be really easy. But it wasn't the case for me, as you can probably see. So I was involved with the panel straight after my last year at under 21 level. Stephen was the manager, and I was brought in on the development panel. Then throughout the summer, I was progressing well. And then there was a change in management, and I just wasn't involved in the group, which I suppose there's nothing I can do on now. But then since then, you run into COVID, club scene isn't going as well as it should be. You're probably not getting the opportunities that you'd like to kind of showcase what you can do. And then getting injuries and niggles and stuff. So I struggled then with my back for about 2 years. I had a bulging disc that was causing me a lot of trouble. Even just moving, getting in and out of the car, getting in and out of bed. So for 2 years there, football wasn't probably my priority. It was trying to get my health and my body right. I was able to get that right then, and then COVID kind of went away, and then I was able to give the club a good go. And then I suppose you need a bit of luck too, where you need the club scene going well. If your club is doing well, you're probably getting noticed. Whereas let's say if our club hadn't done as well as we did last year, I'm not sure if I would have got the opportunity to get involved with Mayo again. So you need a bit of luck too. And I suppose it just didn't go my way for those couple of years.
So when do you get the recall into the panel?
I was chatting to Stephen last year, Stephen Rochford, around the club championship, near the end of the club championship. And thankfully, my performances had been going well for the club. And as I mentioned, we got to the semi-final and we were eventually beaten by Ballinan in extra time, who went on to win it. So around that time, I was invited back in on a kind of trial basis to get onto a running program and a gym program and see how I progressed. And thankfully, I was doing enough to be involved with the group throughout the league and then be there for the championship.
Yeah, so this was your first year back then, the year just gone.
Yes, yeah.
How did you find being back as an intercounty footballer after such a long time away, in terms of it affecting the body, in terms of it affecting the life? It's a real, I'm jumping back into the deep end again.
To be honest, I thought that the step up wouldn't be as big. I'm one that kind of keeps my body in shape and looks after my health and kind of my physique and stuff. So it wasn't a case that I wasn't eating right or I wasn't training, but you don't actually realize the level that it's got to.
Right.
So I would have been involved maybe 5 or 6 years ago where I was involved with Stephen for the year and then a little bit with James. So I thought I was doing the right stuff and I was training properly. But the level that it's gotten to recently over the last couple of years, the gym sessions, the running sessions, the level that some of the guys are at it's scary.
Really?
So when I first got back in the first couple of weeks, I remember talking to my significant other and I was going, I'm not sure if I'm cut out for this. And I mentioned it to Keane as well. Again, he would have been a professional athlete in Australia. And I just going, some of the weights that the guys are moving in the gym is ridiculous. I'm not sure how I'm going to get to that or how I'm going to do that. But then that's just one aspect of it. Then you get onto the pitch, you think, okay, if they're strong in the gym, they mightn't be as fit or as fast or stuff. Everyone is so powerful and strong on the pitch too, and they're so fit. I was kind of going, where am I going to fit in here? Generally, running or my fitness would have been kind of my strengths, whereas now everyone's at that level. So you just have to get through the first couple of weeks and your body then does adapt.
Okay.
If you stick to it and you're doing the right things and recovering properly.
That is fascinating because I think we've all heard quite a lot about the massive jump that Gaelic Games took, I don't know, maybe in the 2010s. And like when Dublin started to push on, everybody caught up with Dublin and Donegal. And then Mayo were certainly kind of nipping at Dublin's heels in terms of fitness and going, you know, 70 minutes with them in that 2017 senior final and taking them to a replay the previous year. And it kind of felt that that was the new watermark. But it's so interesting to hear that since then, in the 8 years since then, that there's been a new level reached. But you found that over the course of 2-3 months, were you moving the same weights as them? Were you putting the same times as everybody else down in training? Or is it actually going to take you until next year or the year after to feel like you're on a par with the best athletes in the Mayo squad?
It takes a couple of weeks for just your body to adapt. Whatever about getting to the fitness levels and getting to the same kind of weights in the gym, but just a shock to the body. You're sore. You're constantly sore and you're kind of going, geez, I'm not sure if this is for me. But that's where I suppose the devil's in your head and you have to just get over it. And once you get through that first couple of week phase, I found my body started to adapt. I was able to get through trainings and I was fresher than going into some of the running sessions. Then in terms of catching up to the gym weights, that's something that I wouldn't be too concerned about. You've guys that are bigger, that you've guys that are smaller. Obviously, if you're a bigger fella, you're going to push through more weight, but it's being able to stay injury free and get to the fitness level that are required. And that was kind of my main aim, and to stay as healthy as possible and not pick up any niggles or knocks or injuries.
Are you excited about next year?
Looking forward to it. Obviously the change in management, it'll be interesting to see what they do in terms of the squad, who comes in. So it's a good time to be involved in Mayo. Like there is talent there. Like if you look at last year, we got to the league final. I know Kerry beat us comfortably in the end, but to get to a league final where a lot of talk outside the county or sometimes even within the county was that we were probably favourites to get relegated. So it was good to reach that. Then against Galway in the Connacht final, where one kick of the ball away from winning it, we get a black card at an unfortunate time, and then it's disappointing then to lose out to Donegal. And again, one kick of the ball and they get to an All-Ireland final. So it just goes to show the margins are so, so fine.
They're thereabouts. Yeah, it's a heartbreak, but I guess maybe it's one of those situations that heartbreak can be utilised and harnessed into a positive thing, particularly with a new voice in the sideline. And I want to ask you for any insight or any tip-offs as to who it might be, but maybe the Andy Moran story will have a full circle moment next year for you. Could I ask you, Shiroz, have you been back to Pakistan since you've moved to Ireland?
I have, yes. So my first time going back to Pakistan was 2018. So I hadn't been in maybe, I'm going to say, 17, 18 years. That was the first time I went back, and it was a shock to the system now.
Okay.
Because as a four-year-old, you remember bits, you don't remember everything. Then you're hearing stuff from your parents, you're talking to your family on the phone, but you don't realise how much of a difference there is between the two countries, and that the culture shock was quite evident when I landed now.
What was the main thing about the culture shock that got you?
Even from the airport, like you come to the airport here, there is, at times it can be chaotic, but it's not to the level of chaos that was there. In the airport in Pakistan, there's no such thing as queues, there's no such thing as waiting in line. People are just doing their own thing. Then you get into a car, the road systems and the rules on the road are completely different. I remember it's maybe a 4.5 hour drive from Lahore to our village and our hometown. So I was tired from the flight, and I was sitting in the car being brought back, and I remember we're driving on the motorway as such, and next thing you've a donkey and cart coming against you in the middle of a traffic, and I'm kind of going, what's going on here? And then here you look at buses or bigger kind of vehicles, they're kind of a little bit more respectful on the road, they're not going as fast, they're taking it easy, where they're the buses have their own, they're kind of the lords, they rule the roads.
Right.
And everyone's nearly moving out of the way because they're just reckless in a sense. So that was within the first couple of hours when I landed, I was kind of going, wow, okay, yeah, I just need to get this journey done and dusted. But I suppose that's just the way people live out there, and people are so used to it that it's completely normal to them. Whereas here, you don't really beep at anyone, whereas there, people are just on the horn constantly and stuff. So there is those differences.
Lahore is in the northeast of Pakistan, and it's right beside the Indian border.
Yes, yeah. Yep.
What's life like in Lahore for the everyday person right now? Or in your hometown, I should say. I know it's 4 hours away from
Lahore. My hometown would be about four and a half hours. It's a small town. But when I say a small town, they could have maybe 10,000 population. So obviously populations are completely different. When you say a small town here, you could be talking a couple of hundred. But I went back and I visited my grandparents, and then I have a couple of auntie and uncles, my parents' side, that I wouldn't have seen in years and years. So it was nice to get over and see them. But even just the weather, I think I was in Pakistan at the end of July, start of August, and you're talking 40 something degrees heat. I wouldn't be used to it, obviously being in Ireland for however many years. So you're not going outside because you would get burnt. You'd start sweating really, really quickly. So it was getting climatized to the environment. But then just the way people live, people are up so early. They're up 5-6 o'clock in the morning, they're farming. Or we were kind of from an area, the farming was kind of one of the main employers of the region. People are off to their farms, doing a day's work and coming back. I remember, I think day one or day two, my granddad's passed away since now, but I woke up at about 9:30, 10 o'clock. I was thinking I'm up early, ready to attack the day. And I come out and I'm about to have breakfast, and my granddad's like, oh, you were meant to go with me. And I was like, yeah, I'm ready to go now. She goes, I've half the day done.
Yeah.
I've already gone to the farm. I've already done the shop, and you're only getting up now. So it's just a completely different lifestyle and the way people live out there. Yeah.
Had you been back to visit your grandfather much, or had he come over to Ireland much?
He'd been over. So my granny and granddad, my mam's side, had been over to Ireland. Again, they have a lot of kind of kids over here and grandkids and stuff. So they would have visited a couple of times.
What did they think of Ireland?
They liked it, but not somewhere they want to live. Obviously, you've grown, you've spent so much of your life, 50, 60, 70 years in a country that is home to them. So I don't think it's somewhere they want to leave, and they didn't leave, and they're still there.
Do you get the sense your parents miss Pakistan?
Yes, at times, just when you're talking to them. Again, they've given up a lot, as you can imagine. They're in their 40s, they're living in a country, they're so used to the culture, they're used to the language, the food, everything, they know how everything works. Suddenly you're the other side of the world, you don't have your friends, you don't have your families. So they've given up a lot for me and my brother to have a better chance at life, so I'm just thankful for that.
How does identity sit with you in 2025? It can be a subject that a lot of people just are too, I think, decidedly ignorant to actually grasp. But as a Pakistani-Irish man, as an Irish-Pakistani man, I'm not sure what order, and I'm sure your parents, do they consider themselves Pakistani-Irish as well at the moment, and similar to yourself? How does that sit, not only in the community, but in Ireland in general for you right now? Is it something that you're comfortable with, or do you get a sense that there is a little bit of tension out there given the way society is moving in 2025 towards dual identities?
To answer your question firstly, I suppose I am comfortable with it. That is who I am. Like I mentioned, if you'd asked me this maybe 15 years ago, my answer would have been different. Whereas now, I'm happy. I consider myself Irish. This is home for me.
Yeah.
But I still have that Pakistani culture side of things. My background is from Pakistan. That's where I was born. And I'm proud of that too. Whereas my parents' perspective would be slightly different.
Of course.
They are Pakistani. But again, Ireland is their home now. So yes, they do miss it, but they are happy in Ireland. They are happy in Balhedrin. And then I suppose the part of tension and people not kind of... We've seen a lot of protests about certain groups and people not happy with migrants coming to the country and stuff. I think people are allowed to voice their opinion. I've nothing against that, but I think there needs to be a balance in which they do it. Like, you have your opinion on it, that's absolutely fine. I have my opinion on it. But as long as I'm contributing to society, I'm doing the right things and I'm not causing any issues or problems, I think I should be accepted here, which I am by most people, by most parts. But you are going to get that handful that are not going to see things like that. that might abuse you, that might say this or that. But I'm pretty thick-skinned, so it wouldn't bother me now.
For sure. It definitely seems. It also seems that acceptance has been commonplace in terms of your experience in Ireland, and maybe there's a brilliant element of, you know, being quite young when you get here. Have you ever spoken to your parents about the idea of acceptance in Ireland and what their experience has been like?
I suppose being in Ballyhadrin, it's such a small knit community that they've gotten friendly with people there. They are accepted. They feel comfortable in Ballyhadrin. Whereas if we'd landed in a bigger city somewhere that you're not as community-based, would their perspective be different? I would say so. So I think we were fortunate that we came to Ballyhadrin and the people were so welcoming and open. But I think on the other hand, when people from other countries or from different backgrounds are coming to a specific area, I think that the onus does fall on the powers that be, that they provide the right services and supports. I know in Ballyhadrin, people don't have a problem with, like, the Syrian refugees are based in the Iraq Centre there. But I think we were promised in the town that we'd get certain services and stuff. When you don't get that, the doctors are under pressure, the schools are under pressure. And that does have a knock-on impact on how people perceive things. So I think it's a two-way street where people need to obviously play their part in the local community, get integrated, but the services and the support need to be provided that it doesn't impact the local people that were originally there.
Yeah, and I mean, it's true no fault of the people that are coming to Ireland whatsoever. It's unfortunately maybe a question for the powers that be, as you say. Gaelic Games does have a role in this as well. And I mean, from your own standpoint, the natural integration that comes with that, like, is there more that the GAA can be doing in terms of what the future holds for Ireland? Because it does feel that we're at this point now where it's a real topic of conversation, and I don't want to be too trite about it, but it is something that does bring communities together, that brings people together. And as you said earlier on in the interview, your parents were afforded the opportunity to meet other parents, to meet people who were born in Ireland because their son was playing GAA with their son. And I think that's probably a little signpost to what can actually happen in the future.
Yeah, I suppose sport has no barriers. Like, if you think about it, from a very young age, people are pushing their kids into Gaelic Games because the local clubs are everywhere. If you go to a small village, what are you going to find? You're going to find a church, you're going to find a small shop, and you're going to find a GAA pitch. So it's so knitted into the communities, I think it could be utilised more. And to be fair to the GAA, they are trying over the last number of years, like Super Values campaign, I was involved with that as well. They're trying to highlight integrating people into the community through sports. When you're on a sports team, nobody's thinking, oh, he's a different colour to me. All you're thinking is, we're on the same team, well, how can we beat the opposition? Even though, in terms of a team perspective, not all of them are Irish or not all of them are a specific skin colour, but on a pitch, nobody picks that up. Like, nobody from, I'm going to say, if you look at Dublin, Jason Sherlock, nobody from Dublin was abusing him when he was playing for Dublin, because it was the common goal of seeing Dublin win. Whereas people forget about the racism side of things there. Whereas you might have opposition then abusing you. So I think sport has a lot to teach us and teach people on how we can integrate people to the local communities. So when kids are involved, their parents will get involved or their parents will get to meet people. But you're giving them an opportunity to get to know them. People form opinions of others when they don't know them, when they're on the kind of outskirts, whereas if you're involved with them, you're speaking to them, you might go, actually, they're not a bad person, they're not a bad family. They're just here because of a better life, or they're fleeing a war, or whatever the case might be. But it's until you get to talk to them. And I don't think you have those opportunities in local towns or in cities outside of sport to do that. Or if there's other clubs, it doesn't have to be sports. So I'm sure there's other clubs that could be set up that could help just start those conversations. And once people get to know the other side, and again, it's a two-way street. I get to know you, you get to know me. I realise you're not a bad person, I'm not a bad person. And I think that helps a long way.
Definitely. Sure, as you said earlier on, semi-final defeat last year in the club championship. Ballyhadrin want to go one, maybe two steps further this year, I presume, over the next few weeks?
That would be the goal, but we have to take one game at a time. We've had Clamorris now the last 2 years.
Right.
We beat them the first year. Last year we were fortunate to probably get a draw in the end. And if they'd beaten us, that probably was curtains to our championship campaign. So we won't take anything for granted. We have to just take a game at a time, and we'll look forward to playing them now this Saturday.
Well, very best of luck with the club championship, and indeed what does come in 2026 with the Mayo County team as well, whoever may be in charge. Maybe it'll be a Ballyhadrim man in the dugout for Mayo next year. Shroz Akram, a pleasure to chat to you. Thanks so much for coming into studio for Settle In with Guinness 0-0. Thank you very much.
Thanks a million, Owen. Thank you.
Settle In on Off The Ball, brought to you by Guinness 0-0.